Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
There is a peaceful solution called the peace revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for taking time to tune in during your busy day. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial free and free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers to the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. Or as James Corbett would say, this media is funded by you and is created for you. So if you're not supporting that which you hear, it's funded by someone like you who thought enough of you to help get this information out to you. That's how we pay it forward. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community wherein over 1,000 thinkers from around the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect, individually sharpening our intellectual self-defense skills and practicing the universal arts of liberation. And to that end, we're scheduled to launch another new video podcast project, Navigating Netflix, which I'm participating in with Paul Verge of Remedy Radio and James Evan Plato of Media Monarchy. And this is where we'll mine the treasure trove, which is Netflix, identifying empowering films whereby we'll review them using a little bit of logic, reason, and a method of critical thinking, which makes a great example of practical learning in an informal setting for anyone who loves to watch films. The first episode of Navigating Netflix will be reviewing the movie titled The Experiment, starring Adrian Brody and Forrest Whitaker, which is based on the real-life psychological warfare experiments carried out at Stanford University in 1971 by Dr. Philip Zimbardo. So, if you're interested in history and a suspenseful story encompassing the struggle for human liberation, you can check it out beforehand or wait until after you see the first Navigating Netflix episode. And in the meanwhile, you can check out the Navigating Netflix group in the Tragedy and Hope online community, as that's the genesis of the upcoming video series of the same name, which begins filming on June 9th. That's the future. So let's talk about today before we get into the history. This episode is a very special episode, one in which I hope you'll take some notes, as there's simply no break in this electrifying 2-hour stream of consciousness as shared by John Taylor Gatto. If you find this episode to be interesting, you might try Peace Revolution Podcast episodes 11 and 13, Human Resources and Psy War, not to mention just about every other episode in this series. To that end, I've been searching for months to find the perfect presentation, as Gatto's books are so prolific, yet many of his interviews don't cover the broad spectrum of his brilliance. And after reviewing everything out there and not being satisfied, I contacted John Taylor Gatto by mail, inquiring to do a video interview. Being that his time is in great demand, I've not yet heard back from Gatto, but I did end up hearing a remarkable and recent interview that Gatto did on a radio show, which I've been enjoying for years. That being with Henrik Palmgren of Red Ice Radio. This, in my humble opinion, is an excellent showcase of Gatto's prodigious life's work, and in recognizing its simple brilliance of connecting the dots, I was inspired to seek permission to share it with you and everyone listening in the future. I'd like to thank everyone at Red Ice Creations in Gothenburg, Sweden, including Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and especially Henrik, not only for granting me this small favor so I could help proliferate the wisdom which follows, but for consistently producing independent content which exemplifies what it means to be conscious and conscientious. For those of you who aren't yet familiar, Red Ice Creations is not only a news website, but also produces films, videos, and an online radio show called Red Ice Radio, hosted by founder, filmmaker, and researcher Henrik Palmgren. Henrik has been generous enough to grant us exclusive access to the second hour of his interview with John Taylor Gatto, which is otherwise only found in Red Ice Creations members area for those who donate, subscribe, or support their art and media creations. So, if you enjoy what follows, please check out redicecreations.com, review more of their productions, and if you're empowered and would like to see them grow, please support their endeavor. Now, instead of appealing to the much-worn cliche of "this next guest needs no introduction," I'll provide you with a short introduction of John Taylor Gatto and his work, and therein you'll understand why, if he's not currently a familiar face in your mind, he soon should be, as his work reflects his friendship towards all who seek to learn. John Taylor Gatto reached the pinnacle of his teaching career as New York State Teacher of the Year after being New York City Teacher of the Year on three occasions. He quit teaching on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal in 1991 while still the New York State Teacher of the Year, claiming that he was no longer willing to hurt children with public education. Later that year, he was the subject of a show at Carnegie Hall titled An Evening with John Taylor Gatto, which launched a career of public speaking in the area of education reform, which has by this point taken Gatto over 1.5 miles in all 50 states and more than 7 foreign countries. His books include Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, 1992, The Exhausted School, 1993, A Different Kind of Teacher, 2000, and his most well-known, The Underground History of American Education, 2001, all of which are available at his website, johntaylorgatto.com, both for sale and for free reading, if you're so inclined. Lastly, if you're left wanting more after the next 2 hours, I'll offer that Jan Ervin's Gnostic Media Podcast has 2 interviews with almost 4 hours of question and answer with John Taylor Gatto. So if you're still hungry, it's linked for your edification in the episode notes. Now, without further ado, this is episode 30, The Fire of Corruption in Education, John Taylor Gatto and Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
This is Red Ice Radio. From the apparent to the esoteric. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome to Red Ice Radio. It's great to have you all with us. My name is Henrik. Thank you for taking the time to listen and follow along in our program. If you take the time to look around on the website, redicecreations.com, you'll see we have more than just radio. But just click into our archive, a year of radio programs with no commercials, for free, at your convenience to stream or download. All our second hour interviews are archived in our members area. Today we're going to discuss the history of education, the school industry, indoctrination, the systematic dumbing down of children and social engineering, together with John Taylor Gatto. He was named the New York State Teacher of the Year in 1991 when he decided to quit. He refused the award and instead used his stage time to discuss exactly how the state was paying him to damage children. John calls it state-controlled consciousness, a form of government adoption, and he's been writing and speaking about this since 91. His books include Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, The Exhausted School, A Different Kind of Teacher, The Underground History of American Education, a school teacher's intimate investigation into the problem of modern schooling. And his latest one is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, a school teacher's journey through the dark world of compulsory schooling. Gatto is currently at work on a documentary film about the nature of modern schooling entitled The Fourth Purpose. The website where you can find more information is johntaylorgatto.com. Stay with us for the next 2 hours. It is with great pleasure that we welcome you to the program. It's great to have you with us, and thank you for taking the time to talking with us here today, John.
Pleasure to be with you.
Now, of course, as I mentioned, you are the author of Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, and your latest book is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A Schoolteacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. And we have so much to discuss here today, John. I mean, you've had about 26 years of experience and frustration with the public school system. And unfortunately, as far as I know, as far as I'm concerned from my point of view, you are a lone voice out there speaking out against, well, I guess we could say the violence against children, John, all across the world for forcing them to have to go through school. But to kind of begin our conversation here, John, why don't we talk a little bit about the history of education? I mean, obviously, in one form or another, this is as old as mankind itself. But maybe you can briefly tell us about the history of school as it is in its current form, John, and who is behind schooling.
I think the key question back at the beginning of time, long before I have anywhere, has always been, to what extent do you turn over the education of the young to the young and their immediate surroundings, and to what extent do you centralize it in the hands of either the most powerful or what you consider to be the most expert? And back and forth through history, this wrestling match has taken place. What seems to have happened at about the time economies became industrialized was the centralization began to win, with the interesting and notable exception of the education of the managerial classes, which was kept free and is kept free to some extent. The rest of the population has been indoctrinated more than educated. Schooled is a fine word because we all know what a school of fish is, and that's not a loose use of language. The kids are to become predictable so they can be employed as human resources. You can't extend that to everybody because, as Darwin demonstrated in the middle of the 19th century, organisms that can't adapt to new situations perish. So somebody has to be left with their mind open to take into account changes in the world, but everyone else is, in a sense, at their mercy. Now, the most fascinating thing to me is that through history, the great names that we all know worldwide, certainly in Europe and the United States, but I think worldwide, have offered different justifications to do this. I mean, we have very early on religious justifications. This is the way God wants it. And then we have in the secular enlightenment of ancient Athens, Plato's justification that people are permanently superior, average, or inferior, and there's nothing can be done about that. Hence the word education is meaningless. They have to be cultivated and conditioned so they won't get in the way of the people who make things happen. Now, if we move up a little bit further in history to the great Protestant reformer of Christianity, John Calvin, in the 1500s, Calvin clearly establishes that prior to our birth, some of us are selected for salvation. That's a tiny fraction. Everyone else is doomed. And so Calvin, in his great Institutes, worth anyone's time to read, spells out from a lawyerly perspective how you're to take the damned, who are 90 or 95% of the population, fill their minds with nonsense, set them into daily competition with one another, so they'll never step back and say, why are we doing this? Obviously, we're doing this to win. And that way, the damned can be kept out of the way of the elect. But if you move a little bit farther into your part of the world, in Holland, the great so-called liberal philosopher Spinoza, writing in 1690, says very, very clearly that most people are in fact damned, but Spinoza's an atheist, so he doesn't mean that religiously. He says they are murderously irrational, and there's no cure for that. And since there's so few of the rational left to manage them, they have to be taught to manage themselves by being stripped of their ability to think clearly and set into competition with one another. And we're not done yet in your part of the world, 125 years after Spinoza, the great Prussian philosopher Johann Fichte writes public letters to the King of Prussia demanding that ordinary children be drawn out of their homes and their neighborhoods and put under the control of employees of the state. In fact, it's crystal clear where they are to be taught half-truths and imperfect information, where their natural abilities are to be modified downward so they'll never get in the way of the managers. Now, we can take that right up to today. What changes is the language that's used. The intention is identical. The justifications change a little bit. Let me do one final one and then put myself back in your hands. When the agrarian economies of the 19th century in the United States gave way to industrial economies, and in your part of the world that happened a half to a century earlier, when that happened, some great change had to be imposed on ordinary people used to getting up in the morning, going out in the sunshine, or in your part of the world, in the gloom, whatever, but the fresh air in either case. Now you've got to get them into factories, sitting at machines. So how are you going to do that? Their parents will resist this. You have to get an institution going that'll draw the young away from their parents, drain them out of the whole community, and accustom them to sitting in chairs, listening to orders, listening to bells, etc. So in my country, the great industrialists, Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Vincent Astor, there's probably another half dozen I could name, got together and put their shoulders to the political wheel of establishing this for the first time in American history as law. You must surrender your children. And from a modest beginning of a few hours a day, it grew and it grew and it grew and extended itself into year after year. Now in my country, there's frequent talk of cradle-to-grave schooling, which must be the ultimate torment. In fact, Immanuel Kant said that tutelage is the worst torture and lifelong tutelage is, you know, that's for the books.
It's an incredible elitist point of view that you're, you know, painting for us here, John, as we go back into history. Basically an ideology that states in one way or another, we are better than you, so you should be the, you know, the subjects of us and our agenda and so forth. But again, the question goes back to this idea of how do you think they managed to get away with this, taking the young children away from families and taking on to themselves the responsibility, at least officially, to teach children about the world instead of the parents?
Well, you can see in the purest, simplest form, you do it by coercion. And certainly we have ample record of that, but coercion has limits that simple people don't understand. As Hegel taught, the ruling classes of Europe in the 19th century, coercion inevitably leads to an underground determined to overthrow coercion. And since history has no continuous governments, the underground always succeeds. At some point, even the dimmest bulbs came to see there has to be a better way than coercion. And fortunately, some Russian lunatic discovered the reflex arc in Pavlov,
mm-hmm.
You know, the bells and the dog salivating, that spread electrically through the world. It galvanized the ruling classes of the world, seeing that if you could habit train and attitude train early enough, people would become their own jailers. But marching through history, when coercion wore out, God's will took over, and that was a more effective, and in combination with coercion, a deadly effective way of brainwashing the masses. When ultimately that wore out, in the period of rationality, the Rousseau and the others in the Enlightenment, they figured out that it would have to be done psychologically. And the early capitalist philosophers saw that you could do it by appealing to greed, that if you only submit to this discipline, we'll take care of you later on. And the people who submit best will be best taken care of. The great villain, though, in human history, and I mean in terms of corpses, is a supremely wealthy, gentle Englishman named Charles Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
Because in his second big book, not Origin of Species, but The Descent of Man, which appeared in Europe in 1871, Darwin said very, very clearly that most of the human race is not evolving, that they're dead ends. And furthermore, and his corollary was brutal, furthermore, if the good stuff, and I do believe he mentioned Scandinavian blondes, intermarries with the bad stuff, that's my people down in Italy or in Spain, evolution will march backwards, you know, into the swirling mists of the dawnless path. This was ultimately the revolution in human thinking that led to Nazi Germany's brutality. Hell is very clear that he's following Darwinian instructions. But more than that, all over the world, the massacres in the Soviet Union were Darwinian-inspired massacres.
Mm, yeah.
Our treatment of the American Indian and of the African black brought to America slaves, the minute Darwin was available, the other justifications vanished, because here was the pinnacle of science speaking, these people are a clear and present danger to the good breeding stuff. And while Darwin remained a gentle, wealthy person all his life, his first cousin, Francis Galton, was extremely aggressive and set up clubs and debating societies all over the planet, including in Japan, that tried to reform the national life so that it made it difficult for ordinary people to crossbreed with the good stuff. Let me give you a specific example of that. Mm-hmm. We're all familiar with elite private boarding schools, but what has remained a matter of great ignorance is that while a few of them survive from medieval times and kings, the vast majority, well over 90%, appear in the 20 years after Charles Darwin's Descent of Man. If you say 30 years, you're talking about 95% of the elite boarding schools on planet Earth appear in this zone because they're storing the good breeding stock there. And keeping temptation, you know, some dashing Italian from winking at a Swedish girl or whatever, that's the end of the world as we know it.
So, John, in your mind, there's no doubt that this is a conspiracy by the few to subjugate the rest of humanity.
Yeah, I want to avoid the word conspiracy, partly because we're all forbidden to use it, even though there has not been a single day in American government history where the government is suing somebody for conspiracy. Let me say that the natural self-interest of like-minded people will explain just about everything. What they learned through history was not to wave swords around and insult the lesser peoples, but to cajole them and say this is for your own good, to turn mothers and fathers against their children and vice versa. I mean, isn't a good citizen someone who cooperates with the schools? I mean, this is profound insanity, but it's been brought about by psychological mastery.
Yeah.
The distilled wisdom of armies in the field and from every part of history, from church life, wherever it's occurred. If you read old theology books, they're essentially textbooks in practical psychology. How to get what you want by pressing the right psychological buttons. So if you put aside the faith-based component, they're really marvelously detailed manuals on how to mislead people into being their own worst enemies.
Absolutely. I mean, John, I want to ask you about this. We hear stories all the time of deprived children in third world countries and so forth, and how important it is for us in the West to give money, to donate, to help in any way we can, to help to give them the same wonderful education system that we have, that they deserve to have the same opportunities as we do. And it's now considered to be kind of a virtue, if you will, to help to spread this violence and this system to the rest of the world, John.
Well, let me attribute that. In any case that I attribute an effect to one cause. Obviously, if we had a week to talk, there are multiple causes, but the academic cause for that was a simultaneous discovery in late 19th century Italy by two, I'll call them sociologists, but I'm not sure that term existed then, two Italian public thinkers who operated independently of one another, but simultaneously hit on an explanation why no government in human history had managed to perpetuate itself for very long without being overthrown. And they came to the conclusion that the people abused and exploited by these governments did what Hegel said they would do. They worked out ways to sabotage the ruling power and overthrow it. And then the whole procedure started again. So both Pareto, it's Vilfredo Pareto, and Giambattista Mosca independently said the proper way to perpetuate a managerial class, a ruling order, is to draw away the children from the underclasses and sort through them and find the ones likeliest to become leaders, and then to seduce them with the privileges of the managerial class. And of course, what you say to the parents is, you know, Rolf is really so far in advance of his classmates. We'd like to send him. We'll pay all the expenses to this private boarding school where he'll learn to be a leader and not a follower. How can you resist that? And then if you move down the school ranks, there are lesser ways to say the same thing. We're going to transfer him to a better class or move him from one school to another because he's so superior. But it's chastening and at the same time brilliantly enlightening to go to these primary sources, which of course are in every good library in Europe and the United States, and actually see the ideas form that then are transferred into an institutional form.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's an ingenious philosophy, if you will, that has been playing out now then for a long time. And considering some of these latest things that you mentioned about the two Italian sociologists and so forth, does that mean that the form of government that we have currently, and you know, in cahoots with that, we have, you know, the corporate world, of course, and other factions as well. But does that to you mean that they are invincible? Are they now in a position where we, the people, in that sense, won't be able to overthrow them, do you think?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and I wish we had a pitcher of beer or ice tea, whatever. You know, let me say this, that in 1640, so 371 years ago, an advisor to the British king by the name of Thomas Hobbes wrote a book that will be in every university library in Sweden and probably in most of the public libraries called The Leviathan. It was advice to the king, who now had the technology at hand to build a gigantic state. I mean, prior to the 17th century, you certainly had powerful political states, but the reach beyond the king went 20 or 30 miles. As far as the cavalry and the army could easily move, that's where the king was king. You know, and beyond that, people said, yeah, the king, right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I don't have any tax money for you. But in 1640, Thomas Hobbes, wrote to the king specific instructions about how to hold together a diverse, complex state. And he said, if I say the first thing, that's my own ordering, but the first thing in my mind, he said, is that where the power actually is has to be concealed from the people, because otherwise, as opposition grows, the people's force will be directed against, you know, the right villain. He said, so what we have to have is in the church, in the government, in the military, figureheads in all the public positions, and the power being displaced So it's unreachable by a spasm of anger on the part of the people. I know that's been done in the American presidency. I mean, just recently. I mean, I have no brief one way or another. We have a two-party system, and one party that calls itself the Democrats is in the White House now and in many of the state houses. But in truth, an examination of the policies for the last 50 years show that not only are both parties very much identical, the families intermarry, but in addition to them being identical, the same groups contribute to the success of both parties.
That's right.
So that the news, someone from Scandinavia, the WikiLeaks fellow, has been doing, I think, human sanity a great favor by simply allowing you to draw your own conclusions about the motives of the people who make decisions. One thing certain is none of the narratives that are spoken to your people or to mine are in fact accurate. They've been devised in order to be psychologically palatable. And I don't know how old you are, and I don't need to know, but I'm 75, and I grew up during the Second World War, where the enemy had an army, a navy, and an air force.
Yeah.
And they were pretty tough. Now we make wars against people with no army, no navy, no air force, no economy to speak of, no shoes, people whose prime weapons are to blow up their underwear and their feet. You know what I mean.
Right, right.
I mean, what's sold to the general public as political necessity is a show put on to keep an increasingly dysfunctional economy beating on all fours. Look at the American economy. Now, I don't know how the Swedish economy works, but the American economy at the very top has a hamburger made out of noses, ears, eyeballs, feet, out of parts of the animal that never were used by many people in the past. This is the prime employer, and it's tied with so-called big box stores. I'm sure they're over there, but here
they're
Walmart and stores like that, which essentially are sheds filled with merchandise from the last few economies in the world that maintain an overt slave class, like China. And India.
Yeah.
And maybe that's too crude, but I think the truth of it isn't hard to see. Our third form of income is building weaponry, and bombs and bullets, and selling it to both sides in every conflict on Earth. How on Earth has this been concealed from a population that isn't the dumbest in the world, without American, and you guys do a pretty good job too, but without Americans, arms manufacturers, I mean, the wars of the earth would be fought with sticks and stones and slingshots. And from a capitalist point of view, what a marvelous commodity destroys itself in the use.
Well, exactly. You have to build, continue to produce, obviously. And just as you say, John, Sweden is a big weapons manufacturer, by the way. But also on top of that, the propaganda then that we're getting in the news, maybe even now, who knows what is happening in the school system itself when it comes to the justification of these wars that you're talking about. But as it is right now, John, this is what is happening in Libya and other places of the world, North Africa and Middle East. This is because we're doing that out of the goodness of our heart to spread the wonderful system of democracy to the rest of the world, to these deprived countries again, John. So this behavior is justified.
Well, that's the public narrative, and since the newspapers, the television stations, the radio stations resonate this official picture, and dissent is kept way out on the fringe. And if dissent enters the public attention, it's always over some minor point, like shall we send 300,000 troops or 200,000 troops? Meanwhile, our nation is as bankrupt as it's possible to be. And the rest of our economy is equally dysfunctional. We produce the fantasies for the rest of the world. I've been asked a half a dozen times to speak in China. And what I notice is that not only does every Chinese I meet from any social class speak English as well as Chinese, which worries me a little bit, but half of them are playing American computer games. And so help me God, this is a true story. The last time I was there last year in what used to be called Canton and now is Guangzhou, I became desperate to escape the American fast foods and American movies. And I said to the hotel, tell me where there's a tea house. And they said there's one down on the Pearl River. And I walked about five blocks down the hill, got to the tea house, got in, and was just delighted. There were 50 pages of different teas. I said, now I'm in China, 5,000 years of tradition. And as I was sipping my tea, it suddenly struck me that if the 1,000 other customers in this outdoor tea house, no one was speaking. And you know, it took me, I'm slow, but what's going on? And then I noticed their heads were all inclined at about a 30-degree angle upward. And I looked up, and there was the largest television screen that my imagination could have. I mean, if I say it's as big as a city block, it was enormous. And what's playing on television? Two American professional basketball teams are playing. That's what. I'm in this ancient civilization, and this clientele of a tea house is watching American professional basketball.
This is globalization at its best, John. In that sense, it's a worldwide culture, if you will, now, and it's inescapable almost around the world.
Well, that's of course a bulwark of our economy, creating both pure fantasy as entertainment and also professional sports. We're desperately trying to spread professional football to you guys now. I think they have one or two games a year in England every year, but the intention is to draw all you health nuts playing soccer into a game where your brain can get scrambled pretty good.
Yeah, it's incredible. I want to ask you a little bit more about this—the idea of a war economy as well. And I know that we're, micro studying certain aspects in history. We try to connect the whole picture here, as you very well have done, John, so far. But how do you see this the whole post World War II agenda of getting everybody in a household to go to work, for instance, instead of just one paycheck being enough to support an entire family? And this is the lie, obviously, as well of you know, women being liberated from the system. I mean, this is just about further enslavement. If you ask me, this is not about.
It's the enslavement of the family.
Right.
If we jump back to 1908, which is a little over 100 years ago, my information, by the way, comes from Johns Hopkins University, doing a study about 10 years ago. In 1908. The purchasing power of the median workers' income is equal to, in 1990, the purchasing power of a median working couple's income. In other words, by drawing, is it exactly what Adam Smith, the economist, would have told you? By doubling the size of the so-called workforce, you will cut the value of labor in half. That's what's happened.
That's right.
So you get two for the price of one, and look at the other advantage you get. Not just cheaper labor. You get the children detached from any form of guidance which might deter them from swallowing the government line, you know, hook, line, and sinker, as we say in the United States. You remove the influence of the family. Now when the kid sees the parents, they're tired, they may be grumpy, they need rest of some sort. Yeah, this is part of, once again, I don't mean to approve of, a brilliant piece of social engineering put together, assembled in the burgeoning university culture of the late 19th century. And if I trace this back most recently in history to Prussia, one of 160 little countries in what used to be called the Germanies, who kicked the devil out of France in 1871, Darwin's year, and unified Germany shortly afterwards into Germany. Prussia used schooling deliberately for this purpose, to remove competition from the state mandates. The competition in the form of religion as well as the family, in the form of tradition. Training would be put under command of the state, and of course the economy would follow. We hear over and over again in the States, I think you'll get a kick out of this, we have heard repeatedly for the past 20 or 30 years that without a college diploma, opportunity simply is so vastly reduced that no one who could escape this condition wouldn't do so. Well, I took a look at the creators of our very successful information technology industry, and I found Bill Gates had no college degree. I found that Steve Jobs of Apple had no college degree. I found that Michael Dell of Dell Computer had no college degree. And that the partners of these people had no college degrees when they were becoming moguls. One or two got a degree later on so that they could teach school. You know, the Ted Turner, the only creator of an international television network so far, said college was a waste of time. That the man who invented automobile rental at airports, Warren Avis, said college was a waste of time. And we can go quite a bit further than that, and we can even go into the sciences. The head of the Human Genome Project, or the co-head, Francis Collins, not only was homeschooled with a mother who let him select anything he wanted to study, and he studied it for as long as he wanted, and science wasn't one of the things he selected. He's one half of the Human Genome Project. And the other half is a fellow who was a D-minus student in high school, cut class all the time, graduated only because the teachers hated him so much they raised his F average to a D. This is the most wanted scientific project on the face of the earth. So we have been sold a massive bill of goods. And right up until, who knows, 10 years ago, right up until the rise of China and the rising up of Malaysia and to some extent Japan was the pioneer because the war forced her into the Western orbit. These people bring a slightly different intelligence to the table, a much different history. And if the idea is to divide and conquer in order that management rests easy on the throne, then they have a lot more experience doing that thousands of years than the United States or Sweden does.
I mean, John, I think it's a very interesting point that you make in terms of some of these people who either dropped out of school and, you know, never almost attended at all, or they were failing students and so forth. And I think that on one level, this has been allowed, if you will, as well, meaning these people were allowed to do this. For instance, some of the names that you mentioned earlier on there in terms of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, the Apple's Steve Jobs, they were people who were, you know, in some regard, they were slamming LSD. They were in the hippie movement at the time. And and actually, these people were, I believe, allowed to be creative. If you imagine that the system, John, is so dead in itself, it understands, yes, that it needs to have innovative thinking to come into it sometimes, creativity.
I'm certain you're right. Let me give you a piece of evidence for that.
Yeah.
I can't give you specifics because I had to sign a contract saying I wouldn't, but I have been invited to speak in China half a dozen times over the last 5 years. I always have to sign a contract, but Apple Computer made me sign the same contract. The details would not be released, but essentially, what I'm hired to do, and I've been hired in other Asiatic countries, they're worried that their tremendous leap forward has come from simply stealing patents and copyrights, yeah, without any compensation, and it's worked well, but they know they can't be integrated into the family of trading nations unless they generate their own imaginative connections, you know, secrets of nature, all that stuff. So they want to know how to do that, and I say the same thing in general. Every place I'm asked the question, I said, you cannot divide time into these measured segments. You cannot tell people what they have to think about and when they're going to be tested on whether they've done that. You can't do all the things that provide the framework of your culture and expect people to be creative. I can tell you this, the Chinese kids who emigrate to the United States, and they're now first generation, are explosively creative. It's just that it's been suppressed for quite a long, long time. But the American kids have, you know, they've been dulled down. I invented a phrase that Harvard gave me credit for 2 years ago. About 20 years ago, I'm looking at my classes, and they're drawn from prosperous families, and I can see that by the time they're in secondary school, their minds are about at the stage that my generation was, I don't mean to exaggerate here, in third or fourth grade, and I grew up in a coal mining, steelworking town in western Pennsylvania during World War II. I mean, we read Marcus Aurelius and Julius Caesar in 5th and 6th grade.
Wow.
And then in 9th grade, we reread them in Latin. That was 1946.
Yeah.
We were excited about ideas. And these kids are, the only thing that excites them is getting home in time to see the latest chapter of a television series.
Yeah.
And I said, what excites you about that? You can write the script yourself. I used to run exercises. I'd say, okay, here are the first three scenes. Now, what's the fourth scene? Invariably, they know. And the fifth scene, how's this going to end up? They know how it's going to end up.
Well, it's incredible, John. I mean, what is happening then, do you think? Is it just the technology, if you will, that have... you know, put a cap on children's and everybody's, you know...
It's a part of it.
Part of
I
that.
I think you and I both have encountered enough kids who use the technology creatively that it's not an inherent necessity that the technology do that. But if you impose a condition of continuous boredom on, especially on people who are, you know, intellectually gifted, they flee for relief to junk, to pornography. I don't need to tell you that most of the use of the internet is to go to pornographic sites, and who knows,
right.
I wasn't 75, I might do the same thing. but seriously, that's what drug use is really about. Anyone
right.
who's
right.
ever been intoxicated by ideas knows that stronger stimulants really have a minor or no place at all. That you can, you know, I'm 75, I can't wait to wake up in the morning to figure out what I'm going to learn from some great mind who lived before me,
yeah.
or from somebody now. But what the technology has allowed is for the managerial classes, let me call them, to create a profile, a book, on every living citizen. I'm sure your press has let you know over the last 30 days to what extent Google preserves every decision you make all your life and the location you were in and the time of day that you made it.
Yeah.
So in a funny sense, they know more than you. The American government is trying to sit on the testimony of a computer scientist in Washington a month ago. I've been energetically trying to get a copy of the transcript and have been put off by agencies. Somebody from the University of California, in league with a computer guy from the University of Washington, demonstrated before a government bureau that it is possible not only to overhear any conversation made inside of a car or truck built over the last 3 years, from thousands of miles away, you can hear the conversation, but it's quite possible very easily to override the gas pedal and the brake. Do you recall the great contretemps, was it a year ago, 2 years ago, that almost destroyed Toyota?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The accelerations? Well, these guys demonstrated how easy it is to do, and it doesn't require much computer savvy
right.
to do it.
Hacking the car, if you will. That's what you're talking about.
Hacking the car so it becomes either a death trap
yeah.
or, you know, an eavesdropping salon.
That's incredible. And again, I mean, that's an extension of some of the things that I want to continue to talk more with you about in the next hour, in terms of what the student is being turned into, if we tie it back to the school system again, because we know about all the cameras that are going in now. They're changing what the kids are going to eat at lunch. There's a number of things that are interesting that are happening and unfolding. But I think that we should take a little break here between the segment, John, because this is
sure.
a good time to do that. But let's give people out there, obviously, more information about your website. I know that you personally are not, online, if you will, but you do have a website and you do have a lot of information out there. So why don't you mention that in some of your book titles?
If anyone would like my book or would like to invite me to speak in Sweden, one of the two, my website is johntaylorgatto.com. Taylor's T-A-Y-L-O-R and Gatto's G-A-T-T-O, and my email there is info@. About 3 years ago, I found that the amount of communication that I got through the website was impossible to respond to. So I personally, even though the benefits of the internet are quite obvious, I didn't know how to deal with the other part. And since I have what they call an addictive personality, where scotch whiskey is concerned, probably should be aquavit, right? I just decided the simplest thing to do. If you want to write me directly, I always respond. And my address is 235 West 76th Street. That's a 7 and a 6. New York City, New York, 10023. By the way, about 20 years ago, a Norwegian film team came to my class and did a long documentary for a Norwegian show called Half After Six. The director's name was Sven Erik Borgia, and I'm sure you could probably get a copy of that from as I understand it, there's only one television network in Norway, although that may have changed in the intervening time, but you'd be able to see my kids in action.
All right. Interesting. I was actually looking for that, John, online, both for, after the program, and searched a little bit for the filmmaker as well, and could not, unfortunately, find it online, but it could be that the Norwegian their state-owned, television network has, copies of it still. I need to look into that, but I haven't been able to find it online. But you have a number of other videos, of course, up on both YouTube and Video Google that we recommend to people, and we're going to link some of those up as well.
Yes, feel free to use anything you find, because my great pleasure at this stage of my life is just stimulating the conversation. I have a great faith in the innate intelligence of ordinary people who mow the grass and go fishing and walk the dog and burp the baby. I think they have deliberately all over the world been dumbed down. But that doesn't mean they can't reinvigorate their minds.
Absolutely. I think you're 100% right on that, John. And also, I just want to mention the book titles here before we wrap things up with the first hour. Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. And your latest one is called Weapons of Mass Instruction, A School Teacher's Journey Through the Dark World of Compulsory Schooling. And they are available.
You can buy those both on the website.
That's right. We will link those up as well from redascreations.com, John. But stay with us. Thank you very much for this first hour. We will continue with more in the second coming up. Welcome back to this wonderful conversation together with John Taylor Gatto. This is the second segment for our members, and we are talking about the school system, the history of schooling, and also obviously tying into this whole area of social engineering, which goes into the control of populations worldwide, pretty much. And I want to ask you, John, a little bit more about this aspect of we ended kind of talking about some of the technologically interesting aspects, and there is certain things happening in school now as well, of course, primarily, I guess, in the States, but also primarily in the UK when it comes to the monitoring of school kids. More and more camera systems is going in. Many people are getting shuffled through metal detectors on their way into school, being padded down. Even coming out of Chicago now, I think it was a couple of months ago, there were schools there that were trying out to, they prohibited parents from, you know, giving lunch to the children. They were only forced to eat what was served at the school. So a lot of things is happening right now in the school system, John. I don't know if you've been keeping up on it, but
I've been keeping up to the extent that the invasions of privacy so violate the culture of my own childhood near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, during the Second World War, when there was hardly a day would go by when some rough fellow, a steel worker or a coal miner, I'd hear him shout, "Mind your own damn business." I would hear that all the time in my home and outside. So there was a guarded respect for privacy in my growing up years that seems to have vanished entirely, as if you don't have anything to hide, why do you care whether I watch you taking a bath? In fact, that just occurred to me, isn't that what pornography is? That you have no private moments. Obviously, the key to totalitarianism is that your mind is open to the inspection of your managers.
That's right. And isn't that this a maybe unrelated topic as such, but the whole TSA debacle that had been unfolding over in the States, I feel, is kind of an extension of that. That they're trying, if you will, on the American people to see how far they can go with their invasion of people's privacy. And in most regards, people seem to take it. It's a sign of something horrible, if you ask me, John.
You know, that's an insightful intuition, I think, because I fly all the time back and forth. And on a number of occasions, I have seen a woman, obviously in her 80s or 90s, and obviously enfeebled, being, if I say strip searched, the next thing to it. Everything taken apart, and her looking baffled and bewildered, almost as if it was an advertisement for the other people passing this surveillance bin. That, you know, you watch yourself, because we have a blank check to remove your rights. Yes, that whole idea of displays. I mean, this has been worked out for a long, long time by psychological and sociological advisors to governments, to corporations, so that it's hardly, it may strike innocent ears as science fictional, just like that someone can listen to your conversations in your car would. But in fact, the logic of surveillance always works toward this point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what is it called again? The classical I forget it now. It's a term, but basically we're back to this idea of an all powerful, all watching, all seeing and knowing government, almost like a it's almost like a theological idea of a God that is being created, if you will. Like the government is God. It knows and sees everything, everybody's moves, and the watchful eye, John, is always there in a way.
Well, I think, although your listenership is probably sophisticated enough to do this for themselves, but in case there are a few innocents out there listening to this and say, well, what's wrong with making sure people are law-abiding? For those people, I would urge them to throw their minds back to the end of World War II and the war crimes trials. The great problem that arose was that nobody who committed atrocities in Germany had broken any laws. They were extremely law-abiding people. So on what basis could you say these law-abiding people are going to be executed? They had to retreat 1,000 years back in history to the concept of natural law, a law set down by God in order to get any convictions. And it's still a sore point with legal thinkers that you reach this point where law-abiding people are the enemy.
It's crazy. And again, anything, John, can be written into the law, just as you say. So, I mean, obviously, when humanity begins to operate on that level, just because it's legal, it doesn't make it right. There must be a moral judgment there. But what I feel as well is happening is that this education system and the world that is, you know, unfolding around us is teaching just that go away from this natural law that you mentioned and turn to the common law or the law that is made up by human beings.
Yeah, lawyers call it positive law, although it's often far from that.
Absolutely. And so I want to get, let's tie back a little bit back into school here again and just to reiterate some basic points and see what you think about that, and we can continue to talking.
Sure.
From that point, school is not for everyone. It's not for everybody to go up early in the morning. In some cases, this is very stressful for a young child. You're bussed, if you will, with the alarm into some kind of semi-unconsciousness. You're stressing to shove down your food, and then you're put into a loud, stressful environment where you have a lot of peer pressure and self-policing going on of the school children themselves in terms of behavior monitoring and things like this as well. When you think about it, we need to step back, I guess, a little bit, John, and zoom out and see what school actually is. Because again, many people will default back to this vision that no, but it's great. They get to be taught what to or to read, write, and do math and so forth. But there's so much more going on there, John, isn't there?
Well, it's a hothouse of psychological dynamics. Anyone listening can throw their mind back to third grade or sixth grade, and you're suddenly in this tightly packed environment of strangers with a stranger as an authority in front of you. And even though there may be notes on the blackboard or an order to read a certain section of the book, there are a dozen little dangerous behaviors taking place right under the teacher's nose, some of which will determine your status or even your physical safety or your self-image. I know I used to talk to 13-year-old girls because I noticed how often it happened in the class that they would try out their their feminine wiles, their tricks, and then when that attracts somebody whose attention they scorned, they would in fact scorn the person, and he would look crestfallen. I said, did it ever occur to you that you're creating the mass murderer 20 years from now who is learning to hate the power you have over him? But many, many things like that take place. I know in fifth grade, a fellow sat behind me. I was a transfer student and from another locale, and you're supposed to keep your mouth shut. He kept jabbing me with the point of a pencil. I mean, this went on for 6 weeks. And finally, I turned around, and I punched him in the nose and broke his nose.
Jesus.
There. Well, there were hearings. There were people pulling hair out. The punishment was out of proportion to et cetera, et cetera. But look, I'm 75, and I remember vividly an incident that took place when I was 11 and stretched out. I mean, there was no possibility of concentrating on ideas. And at that point, let me say that since we have ample illustration that you, in fact, can have an intellectual classroom. I'm not saying that in all cases that's the most desirable thing, but that you can concentrate on ideas and on nuances of ideas. The fact that in the States you will not find such a classroom. I'm sure you will to a greater extent in Sweden, but you won't find such a classroom. There are interruptions every 2 or 3 minutes,
same
a loud
here,
speaker,
here,
someone banging on
same
the
here.
Door,
yeah.
You know, a kid going ballistic, so that there is no way that the mind can practice concentration. And I will tell your listeners this, that of all the many commissions over centuries that have attempted to distill what separates a brilliant mind from a good mind, from an ordinary mind, etc., the only thing all these commissions agree upon is the ability immediately to lock your attention in on something, shut out the rest of the world, and for as long as it takes, you can hold that attention. Well, think of school as a laboratory where anti-concentration is taught, and you're punished if you try to hold on to your concentration, because there is no type of interruption, including a sharpened pencil in your back or a pretty girl cutting you dead, that won't be part of your daily classroom routine. Think of them as psychological hothouses. They're bad places to learn. And just one more thing, and then I'll turn it over to you. In what sense is learning anything? You pick what's to be learned, enhanced by dividing people into winners, losers, and the mediocre.
Yeah.
In what sense does that increase our efficiency in learning to be shown that we're losers or that we're mediocre? And 5 years later, we'll still be losers and still be mediocre. Doesn't that tell us, doesn't that teach us our place in the social order?
Yeah, you're right. Exactly. It's a social pecking order. And do you think, John, that the social engineers, they have gotten the...
I'm sure it's the purpose.
Yeah.
Because I was in the Army in basic training, and I received, along with, well, there were 300 or 400 people in one room, and there were thousands waiting to learn how to take a rifle apart and put it back together again blindfolded. And there were 57 or 60 parts. I knew I couldn't do that, and yet 3 hours later, I could do that, and so could virtually everyone else in the room, because the price of failure was you had to go back through basic training again and be gassed and all sorts of outrageous things. So in that case, the schooling worked, to my opinion, flawlessly. And for the next 6 weeks, I couldn't forget how to take a rifle apart blindfolded and put it back together again. Notice that there were, for all practical purposes, no winners and no losers. I guess in combat conditions at night, if you can't do that when it needs cleaned, the penalty's pretty high.
Yeah, yeah.
So the motivation of learning something you need to know, and I satisfied my own curiosity for 30 years in the classroom. If you tell people, not as a teacher to a student, but as a fellow human being, look, your opportunities are going to triple if you learn how to speak easily to any kind of person, and you're not going to learn how to do that by speaking only to people like yourself. There's very little resistance. Some may learn slower than others, but in fact, they can all see what this is about and where the end, what it would look like to reach the end. They don't need to be A, B plus, B minus, you know, and on down. They don't need to be divided into winners and losers to learn anything worth learning.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think, John, that illiteracy, a failing school system, basically, that we're seeing in many parts around the Western world and elsewhere as well, that has been in the works, that was the plan to begin with,
it's deliberate.
Yeah.
The evidence of that is overwhelming. If we take the Connecticut, that's a state in the U.S., the Connecticut census from 300 years ago, so close to virtually everyone was literate that you may as well say everyone was literate. Literacy can be measured romantically in a way that doesn't require any expertise at all. Take the popular books that ordinary people are reading, and if they're selling millions of copies the way James Fenimore Cooper's Last of the Mohicans did, you can say this difficult book, and it really is, it's huge, it's filled with references to ancient Roman Greece, to political science, to sociology. It's a tough book to read. If this is being read by people who never saw the inside of a school, then literacy was everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Thomas Paine's Common Sense, which is a pamphlet that's considered to have been the match that lit the American Revolution against Britain, sold 600,000 copies, about 80 pages long, I think. 600,000 copies, but there were only 3 million people in the country. So one out of every five, let me see, 600, yeah, one out of every, your math's probably better than mine.
But that's,
when you divide 600,000 into 3 million, it's one out of every five. Yeah,
yeah.
Actually bought the book.
Yeah.
And it probably was read by everyone in the family. Well, the book today is only taught in seminar courses in schools like Harvard and Yale in the United States. Is this a massive dummiest town?
Oh, yeah.
When farmers, you know, and fishermen and lawyers were reading what amounts to dense philosophy.
Huh.
And now only an elite, academic elite can read it?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, absolutely. It speaks volumes about what is happening. And of course, in a little bit here, John, I want to begin to look at some of the solutions to many other problems that we've been talking about. I think that's a vital key to do here. But I want to ask you a little bit about homeschooling and obviously what you think about that as a solution to this. It has been made, if you haven't heard the news yet, made illegal in Sweden as of June 22nd last year, 2010, John. It has been basically banned in Sweden. The law.
There could only be one reason to do that. I mean, Germany did that under Adolf,
yeah.
And it's still illegal there.
Yeah.
And I write in Weapons of Mass Destruction about a German girl, age 15, whose home was invaded by 15 armed policemen. And she was taken away and her parents locked up for the crime of homeschooling. Now, wouldn't it appear that if simply the law was being honored there, that one cop would have come around to the door and said, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to come with me. 15?
Yeah.
The whole neighborhood alerted to this treacherous girl being instructed at home, but Sweden, I'm appalled.
Yeah, absolutely, and it has been difficult before, according to the law, but it was it's been totally completely rewritten here since 1985 was the last big update, and it's about 1,500 pages long, this change, and it basically makes it impossible for anybody to homeschool because of the nature of how the law is being changed now. So you must have what they called exceptional circumstances in order to get to homeschool your child. So technically it's still possible, but the interpretation of that later on in the law text makes it impossible because they've written in there that the diversity of religion and philosophy should be.
Well, you take my breath away because I had, 40 years ago, a brief correspondence with a woman who was in charge of adoption in Sweden. And I was, at the time, extremely interested in the phenomenon of stranger adoption, which apparently had been confined to a tiny number of countries in the world, of which the United States was far and away the leader, adopting more people, I think that's even true today, than all the other countries in the world put together. But Sweden being in the number two position per capita, taking in strangers from the identity of whose biological family had been erased legally. So I came across some alarming statistics in the States that 8 of the 10 leading mass murderers in American history have been adopted kids, that the
really?
Crime rate was 10 or 12 times higher in violent crimes and 6 times higher in crimes against property. So I knew something was at work, and yet when I looked into the agency requirements, they seemed to fit all social work parameters for, quote, a good family. They were mildly prosperous, they were intact, and on, you know. The checklist was filled. So how could these people transferred from wretched homes and families suddenly turn into monsters in good homes? So when I found that Sweden was number two in the world, I wrote to a woman who was at the time, that was 40 years ago, and I wanted to find out, and she said that we have, this was as of 1971, she said, we have been moving to discourage stranger adoption, not substitute child care, which has been around since the beginning of human history, but obliterating some. She said, we've been moving to do that by meeting the women who are likely to surrender their children in the hospital and setting up a support net around them if they will keep the kid. And we've gotten the number of Swedish adoptions, I can remember this vividly, she said, down from 6,000 a year to 30, a tiny number under 100, by doing this, because women don't really want to give up their children. They just don't see any other way.
Yeah.
Well, based on that, I came to the conclusion that Sweden was light years ahead. We were adopting hundreds of thousands of kids a year, and they frequently were turning to crime or to suicide. It's very rare that an adopted kid married, stays married, or has a family.
Mm-hmm.
So I had all this stuff, and I said, Sweden has acted rationally in this case. And she said the data showed us that it was more expensive to allow adoption to take place for all the, you know, the criminal justice parts of it, everything that came from these mentally damaged people, than simply supporting the woman. That was 40 years ago, and now you're telling me homeschooling has been outlawed.
Yeah.
There has been some sort of a change.
Well, it's been going on for a long time, if you ask me. Actually, I mean, this is just ridiculous, this law here that has happened, and I heard about it a couple of months ago, and I was shocked, because obviously I saw this as a solution, obviously, as a way out, if you will, in terms of you know, parents to teach their own children on their own behalf. So
it works brilliantly well.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah.
And there's every sort of homeschool that your imagination could conceive. There are homeschools, I'm not fond of them, but nevertheless, that look like schools. And there are homeschools where I'm going to be speaking in French Canada in a couple of weeks. And another speaker on the platform is a farmer who raised four daughters, all of them adults now, and all of them modestly successful, because they don't wish to be famous. I mean, they're all making a decent living. And anyway, the four girls from babyhood raised themselves. I mean, he protected them and provided food. But when they decided to wake up in the morning, and all four didn't decide at the same time, that's when they got up. It's an amazing story. Just amazing. All right, success in finding it. It's a slim book. It's about 100 pages long. The author is Leandre, L-E-A-N-D-R-E, Bergeron, B-E-R-G-E-R-O-N. The title of the book is For the Sake of Our Children, and it's published by Life Media, L-I-F-E-M-E-D-I-A, in Toronto, Canada. I know they have a website, so I would urge anyone who doubts what ordinary children are capable of when they're given a major hand in designing their own education to read this book. It's quite an eye-opener.
And you have the foreword to that one as well, I see. I'm in on their website, lifemedia.ca, right now, and looking at it.
Oh, it's you know, I receive a manuscript or two a week, and, you know, I'd like to write forewords, but if you're going to do a decent job, they're a lot of effort. So I was about to write a polite letter, and I said, let me read this book. It was electrifying there, because you'll get day-to-day details of how four girls become valuable members of a farming community. I mean, giving birth to animals and slaughtering, and finally they set up a set of businesses that save the farm at the end because paying the taxes and all, there's not a whole lot of money in farming. And I've been in touch with Leandre in the last year, and he gave me a report. All four of the girls are happily in their 20s now, but you'll be able to see them as teenagers and how they do it. It's very, very compelling and completely enlightening.
Excellent. I will have that link up as well for people, John, so people can click in and read more about the book and obviously get a copy too if they want to. That's great. So thank you for that. I want to ask you a little bit here then in terms of solutions, I guess. If you're not living in Sweden or in Germany, which unfortunately are model countries in some regards when it comes to social services and so forth, but what about people who maybe don't have the time to homeschool, or they can't afford to hire a tutor, yet are concerned obviously about giving their child the right education?
I can understand the concerns, and obviously the range of human types is infinite, but Leandre is probably as far from expectations. What you see is how very competent kids are in taking care of themselves. And obviously some of the great fairy tales and fables that come out of your part of the world are about just that. What we have done is to artificially extend childhood. Now, you and I haven't done that, but this is part of the social engineering package. Let me give you a few pieces of evidence of that, and we could talk for weeks or spend our lives researching this.
I know.
The first admiral in the American Navy, David Farragut, was in charge of a warship in the War of 1812. He was 12 years old. George Washington, the first president of the United States, only went to school for 2 years. He started at the age of 11 by studying trigonometry. Then he studied geometry. Then he studied surveying. Then he dropped out and put himself through a course of naval architecture, scientific farming, home building, a whole variety of financial courses, and he became a major in the American militia by the time he was 17. We have so many examples. The second president of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, was in charge of a plantation with 250 employees at the age of 12. Both his parents were dead. There were no close relatives. Somebody had to do it, and Tom did it. Ben Franklin crisscrossed the Atlantic from a candlemaker's family, 17 brothers and sisters, not poor, but certainly with no spare money. By the time he was 14, he was crossing the Atlantic, working to support himself, returning to the United States with, you know, ideas and so on, and working 60 hours a week, putting himself through a course of study Harvard wouldn't impose because they'd know they'd have a revolution on their hands. And not just Ben, his friends in the colonies. For a brief moment, what we had was the rock being lifted, and you could see the scam at work. It's reflection when the scam wasn't working, what's possible. I do believe the first nation that restores the young to ordinary society, their ideas, their resiliency, is going to get a huge leg up on its competitors.
Right. But that's not the point. From my point of view of what I can see then, John, that is not the point. This is about, you know, subjugating humanity. It's about controlling humanity, and the best way to do that.
Well, it's a very conservative point that the people in the driver's seat now should always be in the driver's seat, and their children and their grandchildren. This is locking the social order in place. At the very same time, like George Orwell would say, that you're saying this is about making the social order fluid.
Yeah, yeah. It's incredible, the point we've reached now. What do you make of Montessori schools, Waldorf education from Rudolf Steiner and so forth?
I have some direct experience with both. Marie Montessori, let me start with her. She's the first female medical doctor in Italian history, and she established a system to lift people out of sub-poverty. So it's a brilliant thing. In the States, I don't know elsewhere, the system has been exclusively preempted by fairly prosperous people. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. They have a right to do best for the kids. But it seems to have become, in the States, a very social class undertaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Waldorf is to gasp at. Steiner was one of the great mystics, I think, in human history. And for the people who send their kids to Waldorf school to actually pick up some of the 50 or 500 Steiner seemed to write every other minute of his life, and to read Steiner in Steiner's own words would be for the hair to stand up on their heads. But set that aside. The practice, wherever I've seen, and I've spoken at maybe half a dozen Steiner schools all over the country, in many respects is infinitely superior, in restoring responsibility to the sovereignty, let me say, to the young, and making the teacher an associate rather than an expert who judges them.
Yeah.
There, so I like both people, but the Montessori hasn't really survived the way she intended it to.
I see. And would you say that the Steiner Waldorf education system is complete as it is, or do you see flaws with that too, John?
The interesting thing is that while Steiner left behind a large number of recipes, I said I've spoken to perhaps six all over the country, I've not seen any two alike. So apparently there's enough room for the immediate staff to give a local or a personal coloration to these things. Naturally, I do hit and run, and, you know, I arrive on one day and I leave on the next day.
Yeah.
So I could hardly claim to be, knowledgeable enough to do a critique. But the feeling I've gotten from each of the schools has been very refreshing and very, very positive. Are you familiar with the subject they have called eurythmics?
Not too familiar with that, no.
Well, I would guess to alert each person to his or her own body and to the groups of muscles that aren't usually called into play at all, let alone a classroom, there's a period set aside each day for movements, which I understand follow some kind of choreography, but watching this is like watching sea anemones under a microscope. It's really fascinating as you see these little kids who otherwise would be very self-conscious about doing anything in front of their peers except for the few show-offs, just letting it all hang out. If life were longer, or the day were longer, like many people, I have so much ground to cover, but Steiner's caught my attention, and I've also read a bit of Steiner, enough to know that if people who sent their kids to the Waldorf school actually knew what Steiner had in mind, they would be a little uneasy or worried.
Right, well, he came out of the Anthroposophical Society, right? Dovetailing
the Biblical Theosophist. Right before the First World War, was it? Or
right.
The Waldorf Cigarette Factory in Stuttgart. So his was intended to notice that both systems you mentioned have been pretty much preempted by fairly prosperous people, what we'd call upper middle class in the States, and yet both. One was intended for line workers in a cigarette factory, their children, and the other intended for the sub-poor who envied the poor.
Okay.
A rich insight that people with the leisure and the means to examine different systems found both of these systems constructed for, you know, the economically inferior to be just right for their own children. I find it delightful in a way.
Yeah.
Naturally, the systems have not managed to penetrate institutional public schooling.
Right, right.
Which is itself a rich irony.
Why don't we begin here, John, to wrap things up, talking a little bit more about some of the things that you do work on, connected with your website and so forth as well. Obviously, the whole idea of unschooling is an interesting one, and then you have something called the fourth purpose on your website as well. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's been one of my chief tasks I set myself to clarify. I'm too old to be a guru, and I've never felt very...
It's never too late.
Huh?
It's never too late. I'm just joking, John.
Well, but what I have set myself the job of is clarifying the questions enough that anyone, somebody who feels hesitant about speaking, can see what the real issues are. Let me just give you an example of that. The whole division of study into subject areas is for the most part, it's a Prussian creation, because it massively misleads people into memorizing the requirements of a subject rather than to stand back and say, here is my community, here is me, here is my future as best I can see it unfolding. What will I need to know? And, you know, I mean, God bless subject teachers, some of whom are excellent, but we don't need to know subjects. One thing life in Sweden or the United States punishes us severely for is not being able to be fluent in expression.
Mm-hmm.
if you can't do that with all kinds of people, your opportunities diminish.
Right. Yeah.
Not quite as urgent, but still with great value, is to be able to be fluent in written language up to a point. You don't have to know how to write a book, and maybe not a PhD thesis, but if you can't organize 1,000 words on virtually any subject someone names, once again, your own toolbox is stripped of something better. How about the arts of association? Notice that in school, at least in American schools, you are strictly rationed in your ability to associate with all the rich medley of people drawn under the roof. You're supposed to mediate anything you say through the authority in front of the room. Well, I've been studying the hiring patterns of large corporations in the executive suite category.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, now this will be very extreme, essentially they don't care whether you've had any experience at all in the area they're hiring you. They care whether you're a master of the arts of association, whether you're somebody who won't wear out the pleasure of being in their company either. Somebody you can invite to go play golf on weekends or go shooting.
Yeah.
That's really important. That's why you're passed from hand to hand to get the different take. Would you want this person around 3 years from now? And I'm telling you, you have to look hard to find somebody old-fashioned enough to say, well, he doesn't have any experience at all in what we're hiring him for.
Yeah. It's been turned into a social skill, in other words. That's what you're saying. You need to have, just be able to talk with people. And then one level too, John, is about also, I guess, convincing people, that sense that you can do the job.
Oh,
in other words,
now that's rhetoric. Notice that we pay homage to ancient Athens as this miracle of civilization in the midst of barbarism. But when you look at Athenian education, math, including advanced math, was done as a recreation because it was so much fun and so easy to do. What the center of the curriculum was rhetoric, the art of persuasion, of organizing an argument so that you can compel an audience to think the way you think. That's right under anyone's nose. And why that tradition, which exists in the elite private boarding schools, rhetoric is the center of the curriculum.
And that goes back to the whole what the corporate world obviously is doing right now as well. That is about convincing the buyer all the time. In that sense, that it is about rhetoric, even though they're using kind of psychologically clever games and so forth.
Marketing.
Yeah.
But nobody becomes the head of a corporation, or very few, who didn't come up through the marketing department, the rhetoric department.
That's right, yeah.
It's all about selling somebody something.
Absolutely, it's incredible. And again, the picture that emerges is that that capability and the capability of understanding that rhetoric in order to, the way we study it, then that has been taken away so that people are not equipped with what the tools.
It's taken away from the majority by simply paying no attention to it at all and focusing all the concentration possible on memorizing disconnected facts and lists.
Yeah.
If there's a better way to ruin your mind, I don't know what it is.
Well, because
you're in a new situation, let's recall Brother Darwin saying, if you don't adapt, you perish. But when you're in a new situation, all those things you memorize are of limited utility.
From a neurological point of view, John, I mean, I think your brain needs to connect the dots of different subjects to associate.
Don't ever try to do that. When you're at a very good public school in the state, and it looks like the kids can connect the dots, what actually has happened is an illusion. At the best public schools, they're given connected dots to memorize, not just individual factoids. So they can produce several different ways to connect the dots about the causes of the First World War, but they simply memorized patterns of connection.
Oh my. John, I think this is a good time here to begin to wrap things up for this time. It has been great talking with you.
Thank you for letting me run on. And I do have a big warm place in my heart for Sweden because my wife's best friend is a Swede.
Okay, well, thank you for that, John. And I hope this country can restore its national sovereignty eventually as well. Of course, we're under the subjugation of the European Union.
Hold your heads up, you Vikings. You're not allowed to homeschool. Off with his head.
It's gone long and far, and these people have taken a lot, John. But the website, I want to give that out again here at the end, johntaylorgotto.com. That's the main website. We will have all the links up, John.
Right, and if you want to write me, it's info at, or you could use the home address I gave.
Thank you so much again for your time, John, and if there's anything else you want to mention, go ahead and do that now. Otherwise, we'll...
Thank you. If our paths cross from day, the beer's on me.
Sounds good. Take good care, John. We will talk more later.
Bye now.
Okay, bye-bye. I hope you've learned something new and that you'll start thinking about what so-called education really is all about, and why it has been so important to those who wish to be our masters and lords to take away children at such an early age and begin their programming. How parents have come to allow this is simply mind-blowing when you actually think about it. We'll round things up here now. For this time, I want to say thanks to everyone at Red Ice, Fredrik, Lana, Elizabeth, and of course to you for listening. Tell your friends, we'll be back soon. Talk more later. Joe DiMaggio.